This is an ABC podcast.
Hey, it's Hamish here. Before we get started with this episode, I want to say a huge thank you to all of you for listening to this series, for your generous star ratings and reviews on the listening apps. We're really grateful. We love the feedback. And also, we'd love to do more of these episodes. So we've now got an email address so you can get in touch. You can tell us anything you like about the series or make suggestions for world leaders that we could cover. The address is tmtyl@abc.net.au, tmtyl@abc.net.au. Please send us an email, make a suggestion. Don't forget to give us a star rating and a review on your listening app. But let's get stuck into this episode.
Just because he's short and scrawny doesn't mean that he has to be the victim of all the bullies. His credo in life is basically, only the strong survive, the weak get beaten.
They came from all over Russia in the tens of thousands to support Vladimir Putin.
Strong. He's a strong person.
I think it's Vladimir Putin is the most popular candidate to president here because a lot of people trust him.
Putin kind of draws a line. He says, no, that's enough.
I think most people believe he'll be carried out in a coffin.
Hey there, this is Take Me to Your Leader. I'm Hamish McDonald. Today we're landing on planet Putin. Putin's been at or near the top of Russian politics for more than 20 years. He's been president for almost 19, with four intervening years spent as prime minister under then-president Dmitry Medvedev. Now, the Russian president has built an image of bare-chested macho. You may have seen him wrestling shirtless with tigers and riding with biking gangs. But is that strongman image all it seems?
Would call each other, he would come over, and then usually it was the classical pork roast, dumplings, sauerkraut, all this type of stuff. I mean, he never drank more than two beers at one night. I remember him running around with a vodka shot glass at one of our beer calls one night, and he never even took a sip. He just went around and toasted, but he never even touched the glass.
That's a man who used to share hearty German dinners with Putin back in the early 90s. We're going to hear more from him later in this episode. But before we get into the amazing and actually unlikely story of how Putin became the man that he is and how he rose to become a world leader, I think it's worth starting in the present, right now, and the reasons why Putin is in the news almost every day. And that, of course, is because of the war in Ukraine.
Some of the regions that Vladimir Putin declared part of Russia in an illegal annexation over the weekend.
If people living on the territories controlled by Russia take up weapons, they will certainly use them against the Russians who came and occupied Ukraine.
Some say this war will define his legacy. So to begin with, I want to catch up with someone who watches Russia more closely than most of us.
Oh, hello. I'm Monica Attard, and I am a former ABC correspondent. Oh, that's not good.
No. Yeah, sorry.
Were you in broadcast?
I was, and I forgot to turn that off.
It's okay. Well, I'm Monica Attard. I am the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at UTS and also a former ABC correspondent to Russia.
When were you in Moscow?
In two periods, actually, from December 1989, which is really going back to 1995, so the period of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then again from 2003 to 2005.
Did you like it?
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved every minute of it.
Why?
By the 2000s, Moscow as a city had become a major international hub, and it was a very exciting city. You know, you felt like you had all 10 fingers plugged into an electricity socket at the same time.
Okay, so a year into this war, how has Putin's place in the world changed?
Oh, well, quite significantly, I think you'd have to say, particularly globally. I mean, he's reviled and he's mistrusted, and there's a lot to mistrust. I mean, he gave many assurances that he wouldn't invade Ukraine, and he did. And many people believed his assurances when he gave them. I was amongst those who was absolutely convinced that he wouldn't invade and said so very publicly at the time. And then, of course, a few days later, he did.
But how shocked were you when he did?
Oh, absolutely floored. Absolutely floored. I didn't think he would do it. It's such a shocking move. I looked at it.
Is it as strategically stupid as it looks from afar?
As it turns out, yes. But at the time, the thing that had me believing that he wouldn't do it was that Russians and Ukrainians, they're fraternal nations. I mean, they are very, very close.
Is Putin in a fight for his own survival now?
No, I don't believe he is. I know that's the common perception in Western reporting.
What have we got wrong then?
Well, I think you have to look at the way where Putin's power comes from. You know, Putin has built what we call in the West Putinism, you know, this kind of these various verticals that operate almost independently but are reliant on each other at some point, particularly in crises. So there are several elements to Putinism. There are the security forces, that is the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB, and the GRU, which is the Russian military security force. Then there's the political elite, and then there's the people. Now, I mean, Putin is a survivor and he's a rational actor. He knows what he's doing. He's watching all of these verticals and the way they operate. So, for example, the rise of the Wagner Group.
And these are the mercenaries.
The mercenaries led by Prigozhin, yeah. And so, the FSB has been rather unhappy about their emergence and the way that has been, that Prigozhin as a leader has been kind of incorporated into the political elite.
I mean, it's essentially become almost like a presidential guard for Putin, would you say?
Well, there are very many people who would argue that it's been a presidential guard for him for quite a few years, but that it's evolved from that into more of an arm of the military itself. In the political elite, well, you know, he's got a whole bunch of yes men, they're all men, who basically owe their positions, their wealth to him, and, you know, he is the czar, so he can get rid of any of them whenever he wants to.
To get to know the man behind the machismo, my other guests today are Susan Glasser, former Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post and the author of Kremlin Rising, and Professor Angela Sten, author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest, and a member of a senior advisory panel for NATO from 2009 to 2016. And we'll learn on this episode what it's like to get on the wrong side of Vladimir Putin from the Russian politician who opposed him. Susan Glasser, let's start at the beginning. Putin is born in 1952. What's his childhood like?
Well, it's the Russian, or in this case, Soviet version of the mean streets of Leningrad, really. And I think that's a defining thing. If you want to understand Vladimir Putin, trying to understand the sort of brute, almost Darwinian conditions of, you know, the courtyard and the communal apartment building that he grew up in. And he described in his campaign autobiography of First Person back in 2000, you know, rats the size of cats, and battling with the other boys. He's a scrawny young kid. He's poor. He's hungry. He's beleaguered. And I think that's the key to understanding Vladimir Putin.
And what's his relationship with his dad like?
Well, I think a very distant figure. You know, Putin was born after World War II, which is this defining event, you know, in the history of Leningrad, certainly, and the history of his own family. His mother was literally left for dead, rescued from a pile of dead bodies during the siege of Leningrad. His father was, you know, in the service, like many in that generation, I think was not a very communicative or emotional figure. And we all, unfortunately, can see the results of that.
So Vladimir is often described as a juvenile delinquent, but something changes when he's in the ninth grade. What happens then?
Well, he has a teacher who is a German teacher, and he, you know, as some kind of a light goes off that there are different pathways to success. And this seems to be, you know, one of the key relationships in his life and his formulation of himself, somebody who believed in him outside of his family. It's also around this time that he takes up the martial arts and realizes that just because he's short and scrawny doesn't mean that he has to be the victim of all the bullies. His credo in life is basically, you know, only the strong survive, the weak get beaten. And from then on, that's who he is.
Angela Stent, that sport is judo. How important is that for the Putin that he becomes?
Oh, I think it was very important because it gave him, you know, a sense of discipline and a sense of mastery. He was the Leningrad judo champion at the age of 26. And I would say that the skills that he has with people, to the extent that he has them, are a combination of what he did as a KGB case officer and then as a judo champion. In other words, he might have been the weaker partner, sparring partner, but he understood how to sense where their weaknesses were, their own distractions, and therefore to prevail over them. I should also say that most of what we know about him in his early lives comes from the book that Susan already alluded to, The First Person, when he first became president. And we don't really know how much of that is actually true, but it's the story that he wants us to believe.
I think that's such an important point that Angela's making. Yeah.
Why?
Well, because KGB, Vladimir Putin is primarily a creature of that institution. You know, to the extent he had an education, it really is in that context. That includes the construction of very elaborate even cover stories. Certainly, it seems consistent to all of us that he believes in the theory that might mace right and that only the strong survive, because that does seem to be the credo that he's lived with personally.
Susan, do you know how early in Putin's life he became interested in the KGB, in spy stories?
Yes. Well, he watched, Soviet television, was not, I would say, a glorious array, a buffet for a young child. And, you know, essentially, what did they offer? They offered World War II stories and Cold War spy stories. And Vladimir Putin was particularly attracted to one of those called, I believe, The Sword and the Shield. And, you know, this was essentially glorifying the exploits of the forerunners of what became the KGB.
Отлично. Всякое терпение имеет предел. Пытками из человека можно выжать все.
And he, from a young age, this was his ambition. He even tried to knock on the front door, as it were, of the KGB. And they basically said, we don't take walk-ins, but maybe you should consider going to the law school, which is his publicly stated reason for why he pursued that at university. But basically, his entire life, his entire conscious life, he wanted to be a member of what was conceived in some ways as almost an elite in Soviet society. I mean, you know, we think of it as a sort of, you know, brutal totalitarian police force. I think that there was a veneer where the propaganda held it to be essentially a kind of like, you know, Soviet Harvard in that sense of a best and the brightest.
So I'm forming a picture here of the young Putin. He's maybe on the quiet side, but he's ambitious. He's fascinated by power and is pursuing it covertly. But did he have any leadership qualities? Was there anything which made him stand out? There's a guy called Ilya Ponomarev. He's one of Putin's loudest critics. He's the only Russian politician to vote against the annexation of Crimea in 2014. And he says that while Putin wasn't particularly a gifted young man, he does have some qualities that made him an ideal KGB officer.
I think that he is in personification of a mediocrity. He was always getting C minuses when he was at school. He had a lot of problems in climbing up the career ladder. Even in KGB, he didn't manage to stay on his first job. He was fired and removed to a very remote and zero prospects position in Eastern Germany. That was because he was not a very much capable person, but he can act. He is a great manipulator. He is a brilliant psychologist. He knows how to read people, how to recruit people on his side, how to convince him to act in his favor. He is a very likable person. When you are talking to him, you see the guy who finally in your life, you found a person who understands you all. And he's kind of closer than talking to your wife.
Very, very likable person, Susan.
Color me skeptical. I think he has the ability, if that's the mode that he's in. When I lived in Moscow, I spent some time speaking with former officials of the Soviet era KGB, and a couple interesting observations from them. Number one, there was an element of looking down on Putin. Remember, he was only a former lieutenant colonel in the KGB. He was posted not even to the prestige posting in East Germany, but to Dresden, a backwater. You know, the people who had been generals in the Soviet KGB didn't consider Vladimir Putin to be made of the same stuff that they were. He was not of the elite of Soviet society, number one. Number two, counterintelligence was what Vladimir Putin's field was. And I think that's often sort of glided over when people talk about, oh, he's a KGB. Counterintelligence is something very different. That's the kind of person who traffics in the spies within. That's the kind of person who's going to deal with conspiracy theories and elaborate conspiracies within organizations, very suspicious of those around him and of the official story. And I think that has been a hallmark of Putin's operations and thinking as a public figure as well. And we see that in how he consistently often gets wrong the motivations of other world leaders and certainly has misunderstood a lot about the United States, for example, because he's a deeply conspiracy-minded person.
Angela Sten, how does Putin end up moving from the KGB into politics? Do we know?
So, you know, he was, the mid-level KGB official in Dresden, and the Berlin Wall comes down. So by 1990, with German unification, he's out of a job in East Germany. And so he and his wife and two daughters, with an East German washing machine on their car, drive back to Leningrad. And he's out of work. And so the KGB assigns him to oversee foreign students studying at Leningrad State University. And that was a job that was always given to the intelligence services.
There's rarely a straight path to power. And in this case, it's full of twists and turns. It was here that Putin had a professor, some say mentor, Anatoly Sobchak, who went into politics and became a reformist mayor of Leningrad. That was June 1991. Putin followed and became his deputy. 3 months later, Leningrad became St. Petersburg. That's September 1991. So the question is, how did Putin make that transition from a low-level KGB job at Leningrad State University to become the deputy mayor, responsible for economic issues? The other unanswered question here is, when exactly did Putin stop working for the KGB? Some believe he was still working there in 91, reporting back on his reformist boss. 5 years later, Sobchak loses the mayoral election, and once again, Putin is out of a job.
And then Putin was looking around, but fortunately, he always had people around there who were patrons. And so one of them, Alexei Kudrin, who later became a finance minister, brought Putin to Moscow. Putin started getting a series of jobs between sort of 1997 and 1999. The last job he had before he became prime minister was head of the FSB, which was the domestic intelligence service. And it's from there that Yeltsin's family essentially were looking around for someone to take over, and they tried various prime ministers, and they finally lit on Putin, who seemed to be loyal, hardworking, but really not, he didn't seem to have too much charm or charisma, and he didn't seem to be that ambitious. I think that when he was chosen, they didn't fully understand who he was, but then he became prime minister in September of 1999.
In his first appearance since being named Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin looked every inch the KGB spy he once was. Cold, aloof and impersonal, the 46-year-old head of the Secret Service appears a curious choice to lead Russia. Boris Yeltsin made clear he wants Putin to succeed him as president.
Putin's now one step away from the top job, and the Russia that he grew up in is changing fast. It's opening up politically, economically, socially. Some welcome this, like the then president Boris Yeltsin. But those who oppose it want to return to the days of empire and absolute authority. So where does Putin sit in that spectrum? It's kind of hard to know, but a clue lies perhaps in what happened when he first became PM.
After the destruction by bombing of another apartment building, this time in St. Petersburg, Russian authorities have announced the arrest of two Chechens on terrorism charges. If they are guilty, they'll be held responsible for the deaths in the last few days of 210 people.
The entire country is at war. President Yeltsin met Prime Minister Putin to discuss the crisis, vowing Russia would not be bowed by terrorists.
Every day I think that the same might happen. If not tonight, then tomorrow.
And very shortly after he became prime minister, he then had a series of apartment bombings in Moscow and outside of Moscow, as a result of which, in the end, the second Chechen war began under Putin. So it's very important to remember that when he became prime minister, one of his first acts was to launch a war. There's some people who believe that these apartment bombings were done by the Russian intelligence services to give Putin a reason to start a war. There are other people who disagree with that. You know, we'll probably never know. But then he was able, once he'd launched this Chechen war, he was prime minister just for a few months, and then Yeltsin decided to retire early.
I'm really interested in how Putin puts himself in a position to do all of this, right? He's clearly got some social skills. He's clearly also got the relationships that enable all of these machinations to unfold. So during the early 90s, which is early on in his political career, there's a guy called Franz Sedlmayr. He's a German businessman, developed quite a close relationship with Putin. Here's what he remembers of meeting him for the first time.
My first impression of him was when he was shaking my hand, and he's not a very tall guy, as you know, but he had a very firm handshake. It was very important to make eye contact, you know, sort of projecting a little bit importance. When you're talking to him, he's sort of looking at his watch every 2 seconds, as if he wants to tell you he's got better things to do. As far as being able to obtain a high office, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I had discussions with my wife and her family, who is from Leningrad, and I remember having discussions at the dining room table saying that probably he will end up becoming prime minister or something like that one day. And everybody around the table disagreed with me.
Susan Glasser, do you think Putin himself always saw this trajectory?
Honestly, I find that to be a shocking statement. If he thought that Putin was going to be prime minister, he might have been the only person in Russia who thought that. This is I cannot say what a shocking thing it was, Putin's rise. You know, he is an accidental prime minister and then president of Russia. And, you know, if it weren't for the extraordinary corruption surrounding Boris Yeltsin and, you know, the desire on the part of Yeltsin's family to find someone who would protect them, who would make sure that they didn't end up in jail or dead, you know, Putin never would have risen in this way. Russia was exhausted by the tumult of the first post-Soviet decade, and they were exhausted by the tumult of Boris Yeltsin, you know, and his drinking and his antics and his wars and his, you know, intrigues and his oligarchs. And, you know, Putin presented this image, carefully constructed almost certainly, of order and restoration. You know, someone predicted that Putin would be prime minister. I think that is a very interesting after the fact, because I don't think Putin himself or anyone, he's about as unlikely a person to be the prime minister and president of Russia as one could imagine. He was almost like plucking a mid-level bureaucrat, you know, a faceless bureaucrat from one of the Russian ministry buildings and saying, now you're in the Kremlin.
Now, Monica Attard, who I was speaking to earlier, actually met Putin back when she was a foreign correspondent and he was that faceless bureaucrat.
Very, very early on when he was still working for the St. Petersburg administration, he had an official position which was in charge of Western investment in St. Petersburg. And there was a trade fair, and I remember having to deal with Putin to gain access to certain people.
What was that like?
He was a nobody. I mean, I can barely remember him. I remember his face because he has a very distinctive look about him. I remember talking to him. You know, he wasn't somebody who kind of, you walked into a room and you immediately felt their magnetism. He was a functionary.
So were you doing paperwork with Putin? Is that sort of the situation when he was in St. Petersburg and you were at this trade fair?
Yeah, it was paperwork. It was just paperwork. It was just signing off to talk to various people in the St. Petersburg administration.
Somewhere you've got his signature.
I don't think so. No, I don't. I think he's probably got my signature.
Angela Sten, how prepared to be the president is Putin?
Well, I mean, I think given the series of political jobs he'd had in quick succession in both St. Petersburg and then Moscow, he certainly knew enough about a lot of different people. And of course, as head of the FSB, had enough compromising material on people so that in that sense, he was pretty well prepared to be president. And he certainly had a very good idea when he became president. If you read the statement that he put out, his millennial statement, that he wanted to restore a strong Russia. He wanted to restore, you know, centralization to Russia. Russia was going to be a great power again. I think what he didn't say then and what we know now that he certainly believed is, he said that later, believed that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century because so many Russians were left living outside of Russia. And he was determined to right that wrong. And we see that obviously happening on the battlefields in Ukraine now.
Susan, you met Putin at the Kremlin in June of 2001, shortly after he came to power. What happened?
This was his very first meeting with American correspondents. It was right after his famous meeting with George W. Bush, in which they looked into each other's eyes.
I looked the man in the eye. I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul. He's a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country.
You know, Putin was the guy who was eager to prove to the West that he was prepared for the job. He had stayed up late, memorized his briefing books. He was, you know, very much presenting himself at this time as a modernizer, or as a modern leader in contrast with Yeltsin. He wasn't charming or charismatic. I wouldn't say that. But he, you know, he had a veneer of professionalism and modernity. But then it came to me, and no one had asked him about his war in Chechnya and about human rights. And I felt an obligation to do so. And it was really fascinating to see the mask come off. And he immediately, I recently reread the transcript of that. You know, the modern facts and figures, I want to have a GDP the size of Portugal guy, snapped into the tough guy. And he said, what do you want me to do, you know, with these Chechens? You want me to sit and talk about the Quran with them? You want me to, you know, talk about Bible verses? These are terrorists. These are tough guys, and I'm going to fight them in a tough way.
Was that intimidating when he snapped?
Yes, absolutely. Although I found it to be fascinating as much as intimidating, but absolutely. And, you know, revealingly for what Russia then became.
And how do you put that in the context of the fact that after 9/11, he's the first foreign leader to call the U.S. president, George W. Bush?
Well, that's self-interest, as it turns out. I was in Moscow on 9/11, and, you know, he saw an advantage. In fact, there was strong pushback from some in Putin's circle. But from Vladimir Putin's standpoint, he thought, well, finally, George W. Bush is going to understand why I had to go to war against the Chechens. Finally, I'm going to stop getting lectured by these Westerners, and they're going to understand what we're up against. Vladimir Putin has been about a clash of civilizations and a war in which he's always defined as the sort of civilized, you know, truth teller, if you will, the brutal truths of a rough and Darwinian world.
Russia will be an enthusiastic member of any global coalition to fight terrorism. President Putin said Moscow needed no additional proof to associate Osama bin Laden with the September 11 attacks. The world now has a common enemy. Terrorists are like bacteria, he says. They attach themselves to whichever organism they find and feed off it.
So I think that we misunderstood what that phone call meant from Vladimir Putin. And frankly, you know, it soured pretty quickly. And by the time that George Bush and Tony Blair were getting ready to invade Iraq a couple of years later, it was already very clear that that had not been a long-term strategic pivot on Putin's part.
I would agree with Susan that, to a large extent. I think what Putin saw when 9/11 happened was by not supporting or not hindering the US and British and NATO effort in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, they were cleaning up his backyard. He had a problem with terrorism. And it was the West that really, at least in the beginning, took care of the Taliban. We know how it worked out in the end. And then I think Putin expected that by doing this, and this is where he really misjudged Bush, that the United States would understand that Russia had a right to a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. That's what he wanted from Bush by supporting him after 9/11. And of course, you know, this gets back again to Ukraine and the other post-Soviet countries. The United States was not willing at that point or any point since then to say, okay, in return for your support, we're going to say, you know, whatever you want to do in your neighborhood is all right.
This was a time when there was a genuinely cooperative US-Russian relationship. These two Cold War rivals and the mighty empires of the time, they were suddenly partners with a common enemy, the Taliban. And Putin and Bush, well, they were friends.
Putin goes to Crawford, Texas, visits Bush on his ranch, which is, you know, not many people got to do that. And in fact, the advanced Russian people, when they first went to the ranch, they thought that the ranch itself was where sort of the servants lived. And they were amazed to find out, you know, it wasn't an opulent place, that that's actually where the president and his wife and family went. Anyway, so Putin comes there, you know, they do square dancing together, etc. But right after that, in December of 2001, the United States withdraws unilaterally from the anti-ballistic missile treaty.
The Russians felt betrayed by this, as they had been supporting the US, but all was not lost. In 2002, both superpowers signed a new arms control treaty. But then came the Iraq War. The US didn't consult Putin before it invaded Iraq, a country Russia had reasonably good relations with. It was becoming clear that Putin's interests were not lining up with the US.
And then I think it's all of the color revolutions, the revolution in Georgia in 2003, in Ukraine in 2004, where Putin felt that the United States was actively involved in trying to overthrow governments there that had better relations with Russia. And so by the time you get to 2007 and Putin stands up at the Munich Security Conference and denounces the United States as trying to dominate the world and impose its own system on other people, a very angry speech. That's really the beginning of the transition to the Putin that we've seen, you know, now and certainly in the past decade.
So I want to take you to August 2008. Russian forces begin to invade Georgia. This is a really crucial moment, it seems, for Putin. And the argument is made that NATO floating the possibility of Georgia joining the alliance really pushes him into a corner.
Georgia's aspiration to become a member of NATO, and we'll continue to work closely with this prime minister and the government of Georgia broadly to advance the policies that will facilitate becoming a NATO member.
And that whole argument's gained further currency now with what's happening in Ukraine. What do you make of that argument?
So we have to understand that Putin never objected to the big enlargement in 2004, and a lot of this is post facto. Now, the reason why Putin didn't like the idea of NATO proposing to give Georgia and Ukraine membership action plans, which of course they didn't get because the Germans and the French objected. The reason why he didn't like that is if his goal then, as it is now, was to subjugate Ukraine and bring Ukraine back under Russian control, had Ukraine joined NATO, it would have been impossible to do that. So I think we have to be very careful when we talk about, you know, NATO enlargement is a reason for all of this. Putin didn't think that NATO threatened Russia itself, but he did see NATO as a threat to him being able to reestablish the sphere of influence, or even more than that, to dominate the post-Soviet space. And the problem with 2008 is that the compromise that was reached between Germany and France and the United States was to say Ukraine and Georgia will join NATO. And of course, Putin actually attended that NATO summit a day after, you know, the NATO had decided this. And that's when, of course, he famously said to Bush, you have to understand, George, Ukraine isn't a country. Part of it belonged to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the rest of it was given to us.
So, Monica Attard, if Putin's objective was about asserting the Russian sphere of influence in its near region, or about preventing an expansion of NATO, or even preventing an expansion of the European Union, hasn't he achieved almost precisely the opposite of all of this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have great sympathy for the NATO argument. I know that it's hugely unpopular.
The Russian NATO argument.
Yes. Yes.
Why?
Because I think that it is, for those of us who have been watching Russian affairs for the last 10, 15 years and watching the various NATO incursions eastward, we've watched with great alarm.
Incursions is a bit hyperbolic, isn't it?
Well, it's movement eastward because everybody has known the way Russia would react to that. Russia was promised that it wouldn't happen. It has happened. Putin is not, he's a rational actor, but he's not the same kind of actor as a Gorbachev or a Yeltsin who would then go and negotiate. You know, Putin kind of draws a line. He says, no, that's enough.
You've said a few times he's a rational actor.
He is a rational actor.
How does that square with what he's doing in the Ukraine?
Well, for him, it is perfectly rational. It aligns with Russia's national interest to stamp out a nation that, or forces within a nation that he believes are a threat to Russia. That's perfectly rational behaviour. That's what leaders do.
If Putin wants to end this war, how does he do that and save face?
That's a very big question. I think what for him would be saving face is if the four regions of the Donbass and the Crimea were recognised in international law as sovereign Russian territory.
And the Ukrainians do not want to.
Absolutely do not want to do that.
So
the compromise may be that he gets Crimea, which he will never give up, and one or two regions of Donbass. That might be the end result.
So Ilya Ponomarev, who we heard from earlier, the Russian critic, he says that Putin's ideas of where Russia sits in the world stem right back to his childhood.
Again, as a mediocrity, as a guy who was always ill-performing at school and beaten by his peers and bullied himself, he obviously wants to be the great guy and that world leaders, the leaders of the United States and Great Britain and other countries, that they would love him and embrace him and say how great you are. And it's always bad when a person with deep psychological issues is running a big country. He thinks, obviously, that Russia is one of the greatest nations, one of the superpowers. I think that he is genuinely thinking in the multipolar model of the world. But he thinks that, okay, so there is United States, there is Russia, and there is China. Maybe there would be India in future. And we are the great nations. We should rule the world. So we should decide between ourselves what are our interests. We should agree on them. We should divide the spheres of our influence, so to say, divide the world, and then rule it in harmony, respecting each other interests. He just genuinely do not understand such concept as people's will. He thinks that all the politics is just a subject of manipulation, that when somebody is telling something on mass media, when there are popular polls and whatever, that it's just a manipulation because somebody is paying for it.
So if that's right, Angela Sten, does that help us understand the position Putin has taken on China, for example, and trying to build this partnership with China?
Well, Putin certainly believes that there are only four truly sovereign countries in the world, Russia, China, the United States, and India. But I think he's by now, with the war in Ukraine, things have changed. So China, Putin really turned to China in 2014, after the annexation of Crimea and after the beginning of the war in the Donbass, because China was the country that supported Russia then. It didn't sanction Russia. It signed a big natural gas deal with Russia. And increasingly, China has been, you know, the major supporter of Russia. They have their own instrumental reasons for doing that. But Russia is a junior partner in this relationship. And given what's happened now with sanctions and everything else, it will become even more so the junior partner. But that's what Putin has really turned away from, this idea of wanting to have, you know, a relationship with the West as well as China. I mean, he's really now said, you know, we don't want the West anymore. We're just turning to China. In fact, when the Financial Times did an interview with him a couple of years ago and they said, why have you put all your eggs in the Chinese basket? He said, well, we have many eggs, but not too many baskets.
I want to consider Putin's legacy. We've heard him compare himself to the 18th century Russian Tsar Peter the Great. Here's Franz Sedlmayr on that comparison.
Peter the Great was the most progressive Tsar ever. He brought Russia closer to Western standards. And when he died, he sort of left a better place, even though it had also had cost millions of lives. The logic and the thinking is very simple. He's trying to create and go from pretext to pretext to justify this war of aggression against Ukraine. And he's also trying to explain to his, not just to his population, but also to his, you know, entourage, to his oligarch friends. He's talking, for lack of a better word, he's talking to a wider audience saying, never mind what the West thinks, what the West says, never mind the United Nations, never mind international law. We Russians have to do what we have to do, and we take what we need, and it will be okay later. They will recognize what we have taken.
Will they?
I don't think so. I mean, I think one huge difference between Vladimir Putin and Peter the Great is Peter the Great opened the window on the West for Russia. And so for those centuries, since the mid-18th century, Russia had this window to the West. Putin's closed the window to the West by invading Ukraine. But if this is his legacy, which is this unprovoked war of aggression with, atrocities committed, he could have had a much better legacy. He could have left a globalized Russia, a Russia that was, you know, had done quite well economically until recently. And instead, he's going to leave a Russia that's deglobalized, demodernized. Is this what he wanted?
Do you think he ever faces justice?
I mean, how would they get him? I find it very hard to believe that he'll ever have to face justice.
Monica, do you think that Putin's fate is now inextricably linked to the war in Ukraine?
I don't think it is at all. I think it very much depends on the outcome of the war. I mean, I think that he wants to end this war. I don't think he wants to go beyond 2023.
What's the evidence of that?
It's not in his interests to keep it going at this point in time. It's just not in his interests. It's quite likely that he will have to order another round of conscription. That has been hugely unpopular. That first partial round of conscription was enormously unpopular. More people left Russia than he was able to bring in to the fight. So I think if he's in a position where he needs to do that again, he will begin to worry. The one thing that really, really, really worries Putin is the possibility of another Maidan, you know, Ukrainian Maidan occurring.
This is an uprising
in Moscow. He absolutely does not want that. And that is why he's taken the actions that he has in the last year, which is to introduce laws which essentially so severely penalise anybody who protests that we've seen very, very few protests in the last 3 or 4 months in Moscow. And he's neutralised the media, so there is no free media.
This leads us to the question of how and when he might leave office. I asked Ilya Ponomarev how that might happen.
As a dead body, he has right now no other options. It would not be allowed by his own inner circle. He knows too much. And I believe no matter what, whether he would die from certain illness or whether he would be assassinated or whether he would be replaced by the popular revolution. And I think that the latter, to my mind, is the most possible event. But in all cases, he is a dead guy.
So, Monica, what about you? How do you think Putin leaves office?
Oh, I would say in a coffin. I don't think he's going to be leaving anytime soon.
Angela?
I think that's right. I think most people believe he'll be carried out in a coffin. It's very hard to see any scenario where he would voluntarily give up power. I think it's not very likely that anyone will assassinate him because I think it's very difficult to get to him. And I think there are too many people around him who need him to stay in power because they need to keep, you know, their ill-gotten gains and live the life that they're leaving. So I think that probably is how he leaves power. But of course, Russia always surprises, so we may be surprised.
Angela Stent, Susan Glasser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that is Take Me to Your Leader. My guests, Susan Glasser, former Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post and the author of Kremlin Rising. Professor Angela Stent is author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. We also heard from Ilya Ponomarev, Franz Edelmeyer and former Russia correspondent for the ABC, Monica Attar. If you enjoyed the podcast, please tell your friends, leave us a review, a star rating on your podcasting app, and make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode was produced by Linda Lopresti, Edwina Stott, and series producer Greg Muller. The sound engineer is Kerry Dell.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.